This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You may wonder why I keep making radio programs about climate change, as hundreds of thousands of people died from a more immediate threat, COVID-19. But climate change is already killing far more people, and threatens not just hundreds of millions of lives in the coming decades, but possibly all human life in the coming centuries.
Radio EcoShock.
Some years, the ocean soaks up almost 40% of all the carbon humans dump into the atmosphere. It is a free carbon capture and sequestration system, and it saved us from heating up even faster. Scientists just discovered why that ocean carbon system has gone up and down in recent decades. The ocean responds much more quickly to changes in the atmosphere than anybody thought. And that turns out to be good news, but it's also worrying news in a way. Galen McKinley is professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in New York. She is lead author of this groundbreaking study titled External Forcing Explains Recent Decadal Variability of the Ocean Carbon Sink. Galen McKinley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Like a lot of great science, your research broke a lot of previous ideas that I had in my mind about how the ocean works. Why did you set out to do this study, and did you expect these surprising results that you got?
So we've been working for many years trying to understand what drives the ocean carbon sink and its variability. But only in the recent few years have we had new ways of looking at our data that have revealed these clear patterns of an ocean carbon sink that was quite strong in the early 1990s, that didn't grow much over the rest of the 1990s, and then grew strongly after the 1990s. These are using sparse data sets and with techniques such as machine learning that have become all the rage across science and industry in recent years. And they've really allowed us to uncover these patterns for the first time. And we noted that when we have multiple of these database estimates from independent authors and some of our simulations of the ocean, if we look at those simulations together and those database products together, we noted that they were both showing us actually the same signal of an ocean carbon sink that was strong in the early 1990s, not growing very much over the rest of the decade, and then growing quickly after. And when you see a clear signal from two quite independent approaches, one data, one fully simulation, you know, why? Why is this happening becomes the question. So we set out to explain that. And what we learned is that much of the variability in the ocean sink has really been driven not by the ocean circulation varying on its own or El Nino events, for example, but is in fact responding to two external forcings, the first being just the growth rate of atmospheric CO2, so how fast we are putting carbon in the atmosphere. That growth rate is largely driven by emissions from humans, but also driven by the uptake of carbon by land plants to first order, and that is really then a key driver of the sink variability. But then we found that in the 1990s, the pattern didn't match, and with our modeling, we found that if we added the effects on the global surface temperature of the large volcanoes that occurred, the last big one being 1990-91, Mount Pinatubo, that then led us to recover the year-to-year pattern of the carbon sink, very much like in these global-scale database estimates and large, you know, full three-dimensional simulations. Essentially, we saw the signal in these complex models and database products, realized that that signal was there, and then used very simple theoretical approach to explain it and try to understand why it was happening. And that, I think, the fact that we could pull all those together was one of the exciting things for me about this particular paper.
But I guess I thought that the massive ocean would be the force that would regulate the atmosphere, but nope. When it comes to this, it's really the atmosphere that regulates how this carbon dioxide is going into the ocean.
Yes, and I think that is really a function of the fact that we are just putting so much carbon in the atmosphere year after year. We're adding every year more and more carbon, and we're essentially driving it into the ocean, and the ocean is acting as a sponge that, as you know, is ever more taking up this carbon. But we're in this regime of really exponential growth in the atmospheric CO2 concentration. And under those situations, that is what drives the sink. It's essentially just this pressure from the atmosphere ever pushing more carbon in. But one of the outgrowths of the study is it indicates that when we stop having that exponential growth in the atmospheric CO2, in other words, when we start to mitigate our emissions and start to bring down that growth rate, which of course we need to do from a climate change perspective, But when we do that, the ocean will stop taking as much up quite immediately. The ocean will stop being as strong a sink because there's all this carbon stuffed into the surface ocean that is going to say, well, now it's time to equilibrate with an atmosphere that isn't growing so quickly. And so the ocean sink will slow down quite rapidly when we adding carbon, ever more carbon to the atmosphere. So that, I think, is an important outgrowth of the work.
Well, that's what I'm going to put under worrying news, because I know human nature, we want immediate gratification. And if we're going to have to sacrifice perhaps some convenience or wealth to reduce carbon emissions, but the ocean sort of scratches out the benefits we would have seen in the short run, you see the danger here.
I do. And I think that's, you know, I think one of the reasons we wanted to get this work out and talk to as many people about it as we can is we want everyone to be aware that the physics of the system are such that the ocean takes about 1,000 years to mix from top to bottom. And so the carbon that we put in the atmosphere, that 40% that has accumulated in the ocean since pre-industrial times of all of our fossil emissions, that is mostly stored in the surface ocean. And those waters are in contact with the atmosphere. So there's going to be a period of equilibration in which we're cutting our emissions to try to bring down the atmospheric growth rate. But the ocean is now experiencing a lesser growth rate and is going to be a less efficient sink. And so we have to account for that in our estimates of allowable emissions. And it is, this effect is accounted for to some degree in our model-based estimates of allowable emissions. I think we have to make sure it is that we really can quantify that quite accurately to the best of our ability, that we understand how the ocean circulation, how the carbon system works, so we can do a really good job of making those estimates. But just from a public relations standpoint, I think the people of the world need to understand that some of these natural sinks in the ocean and probably also on the land that are helping us by sucking up our excess carbon, come off the accelerator in terms of adding carbon year after year, those sinks are going to be less efficient. And that's just the reality of the Earth system that we live in.
And as I was trying to learn climate science during the 1990s, the holy grail, the predominant theory was that the ocean would accept less and less carbon dioxide over the coming decades. I must have read 100 news articles that said that as well. So that's out?
So, right. So I think some of the big questions with respect to the ocean sink are also, for example, how much this overturning circulation, say the North Atlantic, Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC as it's called, if that large-scale circulation in which waters that get quite cold and dense in the high North Atlantic sink to the deep ocean and begin this 1,000-year circuit taking them through the Atlantic and the Southern Ocean and into the Pacific, if that circulation was to significantly slow down, say, because of a lot of fresh water ending up in the North Atlantic and making those waters less dense and less able to sink, if that circulation slows down, then that slows the pathway by which these high-carbon waters make it into the deep ocean. And that would slow down the ocean carbon sink for sure. But on the other hand, there is the natural chemistry of carbon in water is such that carbon is quite soluble in water, and a lot of carbon can be taken into the waters, particularly if you add more and more carbon to the atmosphere, which is the regime that we're in right now, where we're just stuffing it in so quickly. There is some chemistry that pushes back on that, that makes that process less efficient over time. But if we keep putting carbon in the atmosphere year upon year, we will keep driving it into the ocean. We will acidify the ocean, which has a whole host of problems and concerns, quite severe. But the ocean will keep modulating our global warming effect. But the more we stuff in there, then, of course, by the time we do eventually start to mitigate, if it's in the next 10 years or in the next 50 years, there will be more carbon to equilibrate with the atmosphere, and so our problem gets worse in terms of that equilibration phase the more we delay in cutting those emissions, right? So that equilibration phase with the surface ocean, when we start to mitigate, is inevitable. But the more carbon we stuff in there, the more water we stuff into that sponge or something, the more it's going to want to come back at us when we start to mitigate. And so the longer that equilibration phase will be. So our trajectory matters. And also, the more we put into the surface ocean, the more ocean acidification will occur. And that's a real problem for ocean ecosystems. So it all points to the need to start mitigating as soon as possible. But the reality is these are long timescale effects, and like you said, we can't expect an immediate gratification for our cuts. We're going to have to commit to cuts and keep doing them year upon year, and it will have an effect. But for every petagram of emissions we cut, we're not going to see a petagram of cut in the atmosphere because of these feedbacks with the ocean sink and the land sink probably also.
So is it possible if we waited, say, till 2050 to really slash emissions and then we go to some sort of net zero economy, we're not putting out emissions, the ocean itself could become the major carbon polluter for a century or two while it emits what it's got in there?
Well, if we really went to zero emissions, let's say at 2050, which is pretty unlikely, then I guess maybe the ocean could become the dominant source. I'd have to look at those numbers a bit to be sure. That's not a kind of scenario we usually think of because zero emissions doesn't seem very likely. So the ocean is right now a major player in the carbon budget. I mean, right now, in each year now, of about 10 petagrams of fossil fuel emissions from humans, about 25% per year goes into the ocean. So it's a major term in the global carbon budget. And then the 40% that you mentioned in the intro is actually if we sum up all the emissions of fossil fuels over all of time, about 40% have gone into the ocean to date. So it's a major player. Exactly how that carbon budget will look when we start to mitigate really does depend on our trajectory of emission cuts and how high we've gotten in terms of the atmospheric concentration and how much carbon we've stuffed into the ocean by that time.
So it would matter a lot if we're, say, at 500 parts per million or 600 parts per million when we start to make the cuts. We're really pressing stuff into the ocean all that time.
Yes, that's right. And so you would, if we, these are calculations we haven't really done in detail yet, but will be worth doing. There's been some work on it, I guess. It's not my primary focus at this point, but right, to really understand, how many years of equilibration would happen dependent upon whether you start cutting emissions at 450 parts per million versus 500 versus 600 versus 700. But it's clear that because as you have more in the atmosphere, you're going to have more in the surface ocean, that equilibration phase is going to be extended the more we have in the atmosphere, like the higher we go before we start to come down. And every analysis, whether it be economic or of potential tipping points in the climate system or of biological impacts or of ice sheets, all of them indicate that the sooner we mitigate, the less likely we get ourselves into a place that we don't want to be. So this is just one of many studies pointing us to that need.
As you point out in your study, at least 96% of the oceans don't have any monitoring equipment. How sure are we that carbon in the marine environment gets evenly distributed like carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is presumed to do?
Well, it's not exactly evenly distributed, but it is distributed per the ocean circulation. So we both have observations, very, very sparse of the surface ocean that happen every year. A few percent of the global ocean is observed. But then we also do studies. People go out on ships, research ships, and do sort of like a curtain of observations of the whole surface to depth of the ocean. For example, from Iceland all the way down to the Falkland Islands, taking 2 months to stop every 50 kilometers and take water samples all the way from the surface to the depth of the ocean. And with those kinds of observations where you actually get a water sample, you can measure many, many different chemical constituents, including carbon, oxygen, nutrients, chlorofluorocarbons. With those kinds of observations, we can really back out the distribution of carbon across the global ocean. And that is how we really know where the carbon that's gone into the ocean is being stored. And we can say show that it's mostly stored in the surface ocean, and only maybe 10% or so is in what we consider the deep ocean. Of all of our emissions to date, 10% of the deep ocean.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Galen McKinley from Columbia University and Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. We're talking about why the sea captures our carbon pollution, sometimes less, sometimes more. So, Galen, you found two major drivers, and we've been talking about the carbon dioxide, but there's also the whole question of volcanoes. Could you talk to us about what you found with Mount Pinatubo?
Yes, right. So these large volcanoes that have gone off in the Earth system, for example, El Chichon in 1982 and Mount Pinatubo in 1991, they can have major effects on the global climate because they spew aerosols not only into the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, but all the way into the stratosphere. And those aerosols reflect solar radiation quite efficiently, and they can remain in the stratosphere for many months, if not years, and cool the planet. So the observations of temperature of the global oceans right after the Mount Pinatubo, and a year or two after Mount Pinatubo, was that there was a significant cooling of the global ocean, about 0.2 degrees or 0.2 of a degree, that really persisted for at least a couple of years beyond the that eruption. And because carbon is more soluble in cold water, this meant that the ocean in 91, 92, after that eruption in the middle of 91, took up about half a petagram more than it would have otherwise, just because of this cooling effect. But this cooling effect was quite well distributed across the globe. It happened essentially everywhere. And so you have 70% of the Earth covered in ocean. Everything gets cooler, and so you suck up more carbon in that year. And that effect hadn't been recognized until our study. And also quite interestingly is we haven't had a large volcanic eruption like Pinatubo since 1991. We can't predict them. But now if we did see another big eruption occurring, we would be able to predict that the ocean carbon sink would be substantially increased in the years following such an eruption.
So the eruption might temporarily help us hide some of our emissions.
Yeah, that's right. And some of the simulations that we do have, computer model simulations, kind of like weather models of the ocean that include the carbon chemistry, illustrate that the signal of uptake of excess carbon as well as excess oxygen actually penetrated at least down to 500 or 600 meters in the ocean. And since that's pretty deep, those signals can persist at depth for a decade or so and sort of be this sort of cold anomaly in the thermocline of the ocean. So that's something that we're now starting some new simulations with the climate models to better understand how those signals of high carbon, cold, and high oxygen waters all move throughout the global oceans.
And then we had one of the few cases where a major industrial country cut its emissions, which is when the Soviet Union fell around 1989, 1990. And right now we have the economy of many countries almost closed down due to the pandemic. How will the ocean respond to those fairly rapid human reductions?
Yeah, that's a very good question and something we've been thinking about a lot. So we are cutting our fossil fuel emissions. A recent study from a consortium of people known as the Global Carbon Project, a recent study suggested that our CO2 emissions for this year will be probably cut between 4% and 7% on an annual basis. And that is because of cuts in transportation, cuts in air travel, some cuts in industry, for example. And a lot of, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty that, and a lot of that uncertainty is about how we come back, how rapidly the economy comes back, of course, which is uncertain, of course. So then the question becomes, if we cut the emissions of CO2 by 4 to 7% of what it would have been without COVID-19, would, you know, what would happen to the ocean sink? Well, if we just, in a very simple calculation, make an estimate of that, we would estimate that the ocean sink would decline by about, if it was a 5% cut in the atmosphere, it would be about 1% cut of the ocean sink. So, yes, the ocean sink, I think, probably will decline in the global mean by a little bit compared to what it would have been without COVID-19. However, the reality is our observational system is not really up to the task of observing such a relatively small change. And we have the reality of the Earth out there is that there's a lot of natural variability that complicates our ability to detect such a relatively small change. So there's El Nino variability, there's the PDO variability that affects, the Pacific Northwest quite a bit. There's all sorts of other modes of variability that would make it really hard to detect that magnitude of a reduction in the ocean sink. So maybe if we had perfect observations and could really understand all the patterns of variability, maybe we'd be able to see it, but I just don't think we will. Even though I think that there probably will be some effect. That said, I think that the cuts happening with COVID-19 are a good chance for Earth scientists to see what we can do, see how much we can see in our observations, ask the question, because it's kind of maybe a dry run for what we'd start to see when we do start to mitigate more seriously than we have to date, and the atmospheric growth rate starts not to get larger every year, but get smaller every year, which is the first step towards really solving the climate change problem.
How sensitive is the ocean, Galen? I mean, how fast can the ocean react to these changes in the atmospheric carbon?
Well, so that's one of the things that we found in our study. We found that really it's quite immediate, that the flux of carbon between the atmosphere and the ocean is determined by the gradient or the difference between the CO2 in the atmosphere and the CO2 in the surface ocean. That's what sets the magnitude of the flux. And so because the atmosphere is quite well mixed and is changing largely homogeneously at the global scale, I think the effect is quite immediate. That's what we found. And we show that not only with rather simple theoretical model, but also with climate models, ocean simulations, and it's also quite consistent with the data. So I think that the fact that the ocean can respond that quickly, it makes sense, but I think we're the first people to really make it clear that that's what's happening in terms of the year-to-year variability.
If I read your paper correctly, it seems our estimates of total greenhouse gas emissions could be off by maybe up to 10%. Why does this conundrum of the ocean carbon capture make even that basic number uncertain?
Yes, right. So the point there is that every year, this group called the Global Carbon Project does an amazing job of pulling together the current best estimates of the ocean sink, the fossil fuel emissions, the land sink, and land use change emissions. And they do that 2019, they do it for 2018. So as quickly as possible, they pull all that data together and come up with a real estimate. And ideally, we would be able to say, here is an independent estimate of our emissions, an independent estimate of the ocean sink, an independent estimate of the land sink. And if we add all those up, we can directly replicate the atmospheric, what we've observed in the atmosphere, sort of as a check on our ability to balance that budget. And we can do quite a good job, but it's still about 10% uncertainty in our ability to close that budget. There's still some uncertainty. And so, I think we understand to first order what the Earth system is doing, but again, this challenge comes to what happens when we cut emissions and people want to say, well, the countries of the world cut their emissions, made an effort, did it have an effect in the atmosphere? Did the atmospheric growth rate go down? Or, alternatively, why didn't the atmospheric growth rate go down this year? Carbon cycle scientists like myself are part of the team that needs to be able to say, yes, you cut your emissions, however, the land sink, there was a little bit less strong of a land sink this year, say because there was an El Nino that was partially balanced by this effect. And then, we need to be able to explain to the people of the world what's going on with the atmospheric growth rate in the context of emissions. And because the Paris Agreement has a 5-year stocktake or a 5-year period on which the people of the world are supposed to come back and say, okay, I cut this much in the last 5 years. This is my commitment in the next year. The time frame for us as carbon cycle scientists to really be able to make that diagnosis is about 5 years. And the problem is that 10% uncertainty is too much. It's too large, and we can't do it within 10 years. We can't really make an attribution of cuts in the growth rate to cuts in emissions until we reduce that uncertainty in the land and ocean sinks. We need to know them better so we can really be able to say, yes, the reason the atmospheric growth rate did this in these last 5 years is because you cut your emissions, the land sink did this, the ocean sink did this, and we can balance that and we can verify it, you know, with high certainty. So that was the point there, is that we need to be able to do a better job of really quantifying each of these terms so that we can diagnose and understand and explain to policymakers where the carbon has come from and where it's gone to.
Okay, bottom line, as we wrap up here, if you were advising a world leader or the IPCC or my listeners, what would your new science suggest about what humans should do and what we should expect from the ocean carbon system?
Well, what should we do? I think we should make a serious effort to cut our emissions and start those efforts today and plan to sustain them for a long period of time. We need to think about the effects of those cuts on a very long-term integrated effect, that we might make cuts this year and we might not see really the benefits in some sense of those cuts for a decade or longer. We know that even in just terms of climate warming, that even if we were to really cut our emissions quite strongly right now, warming would continue for several decades. So we really have to take the long view. We really have to think about our children and our grandchildren. And we have to listen to science, and we have to put some more money into, for example, observing the ocean and really being able to quantify these things so we can make better decisions as the Earth systems evolve in response to our in response to our mitigation efforts and in response to the climate change that's already occurring. But I think that long view is, you know, we got to understand the Earth, and we got to take that long view of, you know, we're talking about planet Earth, space, you know, our great lifeboat Earth here, and it doesn't operate entirely on human timescales, and we have to be respectful of that.
Amen. We have been speaking with Dr. Galen McKinley from Columbia University and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. She led the new paper published in the AGU Advances on June 3rd. You can find links to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Galen, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Tim Palmer is Royal Society Research Professor in Climate Physics at Oxford University, formerly at the UK government's Met Office and the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. Tim's work is now used by climate modellers all over the world. Palmer has won top scientific awards in both climate and weather forecasting. He is an internationally known expert in his field. When Tim Palmer warns extreme climate change is advancing faster and farther than predicted, we need to listen very closely. From the UK, Dr. Tim Palmer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
So it's been a maxim, if humans double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere compared to 1750 before we started all this, scientists expect the mean temperature here on Earth would be 3 degrees centigrade hotter, and that's been a bedrock for decades. Why are multiple scientists and institutions having to rethink that?
Well, but the first thing to say is that we don't actually know, even before the latest research, we didn't know precisely, and we didn't have precise figures on how much the Earth would warm as a result of a doubling of carbon dioxide concentration. So the number 3 degrees that you just mentioned, you should really think of that as an average of a range of estimates that went from somewhere between 1.5 degrees at the very lowest end up to about 4.5 degrees at the upper end. And we always thought that those two numbers, 1.5 and 4.5, would bracket the range of possible warmings that we would see as a result of carbon dioxide. So what's happened is that quite unexpectedly, a number of models from the very latest round of climate models that feed into these IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessments, are now producing warmings that go outside that range, and they go at the warmer end. They're going up to 5 or even 5.5 degrees warming for a doubling of carbon dioxide, and that is certainly unprecedented amongst the models, you know, to date. And we've been running models for, I don't know, best part of 40 years probably. So it's both a concern and a surprise that now these most sophisticated, the latest generation of models, a number of them at least, are producing these much larger warmings.
Who are some of the official research groups who are encountering this higher possibility?
Well, it's the UK Met Office, the Hadley Centre from the UK Met Office, which is certainly one of the top models. The National Center for Atmospheric Research in the U.S., the U.S. Department of Energy's climate model, and I think there are one or two others. But so obviously, you know, your question is then what's kind of changed about these models? One of the things that's changed is the way in which the models represent clouds. Now, clouds are a kind of critical part of the whole climate change question, because how clouds adapt or adjust, rather, I should say, to increasing levels of carbon dioxide will determine whether clouds act as a kind of damper on climate change, whether they will, you know, make it less warm than it would otherwise be, or whether they will amplify climate change by making it warmer than would otherwise be. And this has always been the single biggest uncertainty in projections of climate change. And the range of values that I talked about before, 1.5 to 4.5, the previous range of values, was mostly predicated on the fact that we did not, and we still don't to this day, have a complete understanding of how clouds will affect the amount of global warming that we see from our emissions of carbon dioxide.
I'd like to come back to the cloud problem in more detail, but first let's talk about your article published in that top journal, Nature. The title is Short-Term Tests Validate Long-Term Estimates of Climate Change. It seems incredible to me that weather forecasts for a mere 6 hours could tell us anything about climate change hundreds of years from now. Please take as long as you need to explain, how is that possible?
Well, it is indeed peculiar, but nevertheless, this is the case. And the story behind this Nature article goes back several years, when some colleagues of mine published a paper claiming that it was possible that this climate sensitivity, so how much warming we get from a doubling of carbon dioxide, could be as large as 10 or 11 degrees. And this was a very interesting project. This is from a few years ago now, but they took a Met Office, UK Met Office climate model, and configured it so that it could run on people's PCs. So it was a relatively low-resolution version of the climate model, but nevertheless a credible one. And what they did was it was kind of a citizen science project where people could download a version of the Met Office climate model and do their own kind of climate change experiment on their own personal computer. Now, the thing was that each model that was downloaded by the public had very, very slightly different parameter settings. Now, I need to explain what parameters are now. So when you run a climate model, you're trying to represent the atmosphere and the oceans, indeed the oceans and atmosphere, as a fluid, and we have well-defined equations which govern how fluids behave, the Newton's laws of motion and all that sort of thing. But there are always processes and phenomena like clouds. Clouds are a good example of a process which you can't resolve by the grid in your model. So you can't represent a cloud as a sort of fluid dynamical object. And clouds have to be represented in approximate ways in climate models. And that was true of this particular study, and it's still true today, even of the most advanced models in the world, that clouds are represented by what I would call approximate formulae rather than strict fluid dynamical equations. And these formulae have three parameters that you just have to set. You have to, you know, you have to appeal to observations and maybe appeal to theory and appeal in a way to a kind of your gut feeling about what the values for these parameters are. And an example of a parameter could be how much air is mixed inside a cloud from the outside environment. You know, the models can't represent cloud processes, so the mixing between what's called cloudy air and environmental air, the dry environmental air and the moist cloudy air, is something that's just set by a parameter in the model. So when in the citizen science project, people were downloading different versions of the model, and some of them, this particular parameter, actually, how air is mixed between the environmental air and the cloudy air, was changed slightly. And the ones where this parameter was smaller than it typically is tended to produce very large warmings due to a doubling of carbon dioxide. And the paper that my colleagues published said that we can't rule out these large amounts of warming because the basic climate that the models produce with these lowered parameter values is really not much different to the climate of the model where the parameters have their sort of standard settings. Now, I got kind of curious about this result and wondered, well, you know, if you're forecasting the weather tomorrow, let's say, a key thing you'll want to know about the weather is what is likely to be the daily maximum temperature. How hot will it get, you know, at the hottest part of the day tomorrow? And if you get your clouds, the representation of your clouds, completely wrong in your model, so you get it much too cloudy on a day, you know, when in reality there's very little cloud, then that will affect your prediction of tomorrow's daily maximum temperature. Or conversely, you know, if you have not enough clouds, then on a hot summer's day, you might find your daily maximum temperature is much too warm. So I asked the question, with these reduced values of these cloud parameters, what would actually happen to a weather forecast? Suppose you just ran a weather forecast for 6 hours. Would it get better or would it get worse? And what we found, I did this with a colleague, I should say, Mark Rodwell from the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. We took that model, which incidentally is literally the world's premier weather forecast model, and changed the parameters that led to this large global warming that my colleagues were seeing with the Citizen Science Project. And we showed that, in fact, the kind of cloudiness was so degraded, even after 6 hours, that the weather forecasts were pretty much lousy, I would say. They were really poor. And, you know, you would never, if you were in a weather forecast center, you would never in a million years adopt these parameter settings, these reduced values of this mixing of cloudy air parameter. You'd never introduce that into your weather forecast model because you knew that it would make forecasts worse. So in this way, we could sort of discount the models that were producing this very large global warming. Anyway, so that was a study that was done a few years ago, and I kind of made the case in the paper that this should be a pretty standard test to do on climate models. But the problem is that most climate centers don't have that capability to run weather forecasts. It's quite a sort of, it requires some additional software that most climate centers don't have. But the one exception to that was the Met Office. The Met Office in the UK have in fact, they call it a unified model because it does both weather. The same model system is used for both weather and climate predictions. So when these new results came out with this larger global warming, the very latest results with 5.5 degrees, I asked them, can you do this weather forecast test? Can you, the changes you made to the model that made it produce more global warming, would they actually produce a better weather forecast or a worse weather forecast? And if they produce a worse weather forecast, you can discount these values. You can say, well, okay, this is probably not the way the climate is going to go. The result, however, turned out to be the opposite. In fact, in this particular case, the changes that were made to the model made the weather forecast better, not worse. So the conclusion is, therefore, that one actually should be genuinely concerned about these higher values. They probably do represent improved representations of clouds and improved physics.
Your paper talks about a catastrophic warming of perhaps 5 degrees C when atmospheric carbon dioxide reaches 560 parts per million. That's the doubling. On our current emissions path, do we know what year that doubling is expected to occur?
Well, the term climate sensitivity is a fairly kind of abstract idea because, as you say, what it means is it's the amount of warming that will happen in the atmosphere once the atmosphere equilibrates to this new level of doubled carbon dioxide. So if we doubled it overnight, you know, we're not going to double it overnight, but if we were to double it overnight, we wouldn't see the atmosphere warm by 5 degrees overnight. And it's a gradual, the equilibration actually takes hundreds of years. I mean, by the time, it really depends on which parts of the climate system you want to equilibrate. I mean, the deep oceans would maybe take even thousands of years to equilibrate to that. But I would say, as far as the atmosphere is concerned, most of the equilibration probably occurs within, you know, 100 to 200 years, that sort of thing. So it's not, you know, when we talk about 5 degrees warming, it's not something that will happen probably in this century. But, you know, if you're equilibrating to a 5 degree warming, then it means, you know, for example, by the time we reach 2100, we may well have got, you know, 3 or possibly even 4 degrees of warming out of that. So, you know, knowing that the climate sensitivity is high is a matter of concern, even if we're only bothered about what the climate's going to be like in the coming 80 years or the left of this century.
But we're committing the rest of humanity in the future to living in a much hotter world.
We are indeed. We're committing humanity for the foreseeable future. I think this is, you know, this is an issue people don't fully appreciate about carbon dioxide. The current pandemic actually is quite a good example of when we stop emitting, for example, particulates of pollution and, you know, these enhanced nitrogen dioxide levels from vehicles, we've all stopped driving, or at least we did in the early days of the pandemic. And we saw very quickly that the atmosphere would kind of clean itself out. You know, the particulates would rain out or drop out relatively quickly. So on timescales of a few weeks, the standard levels of pollution would drop to almost to pollution-free levels very quickly. But with carbon dioxide, it's not like that at all. You know, carbon dioxide is a very well mixed gas in the atmosphere. And once we put it into the atmosphere, it basically, you know, the enhanced levels of carbon dioxide stay there for, you know, potentially thousands of years. So when we emit carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, unless we can find very clever ways of sucking it out, which we haven't really done so far, then, you know, we're committing humanity to a very long-term future of enhanced warming, and of course all the changed weather patterns that go with that.
What do these new and more serious results from the models tell us about how soon we might reach the 2 degrees C of warming, which was the alleged danger zone, and how much time we have left to act upon this?
Well, certainly it means the 2 degrees C is happening much quicker. It will happen this century for sure. I think there's very little doubt about that. I mean, if these results are right, I think it's going to be very hard indeed to try to keep to this 1.5 degree target of Paris, and indeed 2 degrees may be pretty tough. And that's why, you know, it's important to remember there isn't a kind of a formula which says for a given amount of carbon emissions, we will warm by a certain amount. There is a range, and I think the latest results are suggesting the range should be pushed upwards, you know, to greater values. So I think it puts the emphasis on cutting our emissions to zero and hopefully even having technology which can suck CO2 out, although that may be very, very difficult to do at scale, as urgently as possible. I think that's all I can say about that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Oxford professor in climate physics, Tim Palmer. Well, due to the pandemic and subsequent economic difficulty, some universities are closed while they try to remodel into online institutions. Budgets will be tighter than ever, even at research institutions. You're talking about unification of weather forecasting and climate modeling, but that's expensive and it needs supercomputers in some cases. How can we do that?
When you say it's expensive, I would say, well, I don't know, compared to what? You know, just the other week, Elon Musk sent a rocket up to the space station, which I looked it up, which has, we the taxpayers, and I think that includes Canada, the UK, the US, and other countries, have spent $150 billion on. $150 billion. Now, you know, I don't know exactly what science has been done in the space station that warrants $150 billion. But I think if we could spend a tiny fraction of that, you know, 1% maybe would be enough on trying to, you know, pool our international resources to create, you know, I said this on another interview, instead of an international space station, an international climate station, and this doesn't have to be in space, this can be on Earth, you know, funded with one or two of those $150 billion, the object of which would be to, you know, develop climate models with a level of precision and accuracy and resolution that, you know, is just impossible to attain at an institutional level, then I think actually we could beat down a lot of these uncertainties about how much warming will happen, what will happen to clouds, and above all, what will happen to local weather patterns, which is going to, you know, is crucial for how, you know, society adapts and adjusts to climate change. So I don't think this is an expensive, you know, compared, for example, to what we spend on space, on astronomy, or indeed particle physics. Think about the Large Hadron Collider. Again, that's another multi-billion type of project. I think we haven't treated climate modeling with anything like the same level of ambition and commitment. So, you know, I don't think in the big scheme of things, putting some funding into an international climate prediction center would be expensive compared with many other projects that we do fund internationally.
You've raised the difficulty of clouds several times, and pardon a layperson's questions, but we have mountains of satellite images of Earth over the decades. Why can't we just calculate the amount of cloud cover and then see if they're cooling or warming the place?
Well, clouds are of course, very, you know, you can look out the window and you see clouds are extremely complicated things. And it's actually extremely difficult to observe whether the total cloud cover, because this is the point. The question is the total cloud cover, is the cloud cover of the planet systematically changing in one direction or the other? Is it going up or is it going down? And there's a subtlety to that because we need to know separately whether low-level clouds are going up or down in amount, not in altitude, but in amount, and whether high-level clouds are going up or down as well, separately. This is actually a very difficult thing to do. There is no overwhelming evidence yet that clouds are systematically changing. But one of the problems is that satellites don't last a long time. Satellite instrumentations only last a few years. And so if you go back over, you know, some decades, you have to try to blend together data from different satellites. And the problem is that the calibration, you have to then calibrate data from one satellite with data from another to make sure you're not just seeing something spurious because the instrument is slightly different from the one before. And the changes, if there is a change in cloud cover over the last, say, 20 years, it's smaller than the uncertainties due to these instrumental calibration effects. So we can't, the bottom line is we can't yet appeal to observations to tell us whether climate change is systematically affecting clouds or not. The effect is currently too small. But all the models suggest, you know, this is something that becomes more substantial when climate change becomes more important or bigger in amplitude. So by the middle of the century, I think we will know one way or another whether clouds are going to be our sort of savior, which means that the cloud cover, low-level cloud cover, increases and sort of offsets the climate change signal. Because if low-level cloud cover gets more and more extensive, then these clouds are reflecting sunlight back to space, so they're offsetting the warming. Or are clouds going to be our kind of nemesis by going in the other direction and starting to evaporate as climate change kicks in, which means that they will be, if you like, because they're no longer now reflecting sunlight back to space, they're adding to the climate change problem. So we'll have to wait, I guess, you know, maybe another 30 or 40 years if we're going to find this out from observations. And so if we want to know the answer to this question sooner than that, the only The only other option is to develop models which where the representation of clouds is good enough to answer these questions with certainty. And at the moment, the models aren't sort of resolved enough. They don't have enough detail to be able to answer these questions, other than in a very kind of probabilistic way. But as I say, the latest results suggest things aren't looking so good. It looks like, you know, based on the fact that the weather forecasting test, if you like, that we've done, Met Office, I should say, have done most recently, suggests that clouds are not going to be our saviour. They're going to go the wrong direction. In other words, they're going to start to dissipate as climate change proceeds.
In 2009, the 4 Degrees and Beyond International Climate Conference convened at Oxford, and although many top scientists presented there, I recall thinking they were still the daring minority outside the mainstream. Tim Palmer, how does that look now with your predictions about the newest models?
Look, I mean, you know, I don't want to kind of overstate things too much by saying categorically we know now for certain the climate change is going to be catastrophic, you know, it's going to wipe the human race out or something like that. There are still big uncertainties, and anybody that tells you, you know, categorically climate change will be an existential crisis, they don't know. They don't understand the uncertainties, and there still are big uncertainties, and most of the uncertainties hinge around clouds. But all I'm trying to point out is that we just have yet another new piece of evidence which has come from a completely different, if you like, a completely different area of research than has traditionally been the case in climate. So the new area is to test these climate, or test one particular climate model in a weather forecasting type of environment, which as I mentioned earlier, is not something most climate models can do. And what we found is that the change that were made to clouds, which would cause more climate change, also improved the weather forecast. It made the weather forecast better. So this is not categorical proof. It's not like I have a mathematical proof that therefore, you know, clouds are going to be an amplifier of climate change and they're going to make things catastrophically bad. But I'm just providing another element, if you like, or another piece of work into the mix, which should make us and should make the politicians think even harder about how to cut our emissions with all possible speed in the coming years ahead.
As we wrap up here, Tim, I've been asking several scientists this question. Should the next convention of the parties, the COP25 planned for Scotland next December, be held as a virtual conference instead of being postponed for a year later? At least that way the whole world could attend. Tim Palmer, what do you think?
It's a tricky one, that one, because, you know, in my own field, I have, in the last few months, you know, I've done a number of meetings and given a number of talks, you know, via the internet where I might otherwise have traveled. And clearly, you know, that's been good for my carbon footprint. It's been good for the environment. But where you actually lose out a little bit is in the discussions that you have in the coffee breaks and in the corridors, which you don't particularly plan. It's not like something you can predict you'll have. But, you know, you just bump into somebody and they say, oh, you know, I heard your talk, but I didn't understand this. And you talk about that. And then that triggers an idea. And then you suddenly realize you've got some new things that really have blossomed out of this unexpected conversation. My guess is in COP, these sorts of things are actually pretty important amongst the politicians. And I just don't know whether you would get that sort of interaction if it was done in a purely virtual type of environment. So I think if you're forcing me to make a statement here, I know that there's a lot of pros in having everything done virtually and things, but I think the fact that COP is an occasion where the politicians can come and actually talk to each other and maybe make the sorts of deals that politicians do, I don't know, is possibly a good thing. So I'm going to sort of stick my neck out and say I hope it's not purely virtual.
Most of the scientists I've talked to agree with you so far, although I must say I haven't talked with the younger scientists. Maybe they would have a different opinion. From the University of Oxford, we have been speaking with a world leader in climate and weather forecasting, Professor Tim Palmer. Find links to his work in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Professor Tim Palmer just brought home so much important news about climate change and the still-developing state of climate science. I'd like to talk about just one example. Scientists often use a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to measure the sensitivity of Earth's climate system and how hot it would be at that point when it's double. For decades, scientists concluded Earth would warm about 3 degrees C as a mean average at the doubling point. Now we learn it would be 5 degrees C hotter then. But when is the doubling? No one would say. From various records, including air in ice core samples, we know carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in 1750 was about 280 parts per million. That was before the fossil fuel age began. In the spring of 2020, CO2 is about 417 parts per million. Since we are currently adding carbon furiously at a rate of about 3 parts per million each year, simple math makes the date of arriving at double CO2, around 560 parts per million, would happen around 2067, let's say 2070. But, Palmer explains, nobody expects the mean temperature of the Earth to be 5 degrees C hotter by 2070 or any time during this century. The doubling used by science is the expected warming that will arrive, but perhaps a century or two later, when Earth's system of atmosphere, land, and oceans create a new normal state, technically called equilibration. There is a big lag time between carbon dioxide levels and the resulting warming, principally due to the time it takes to heat the ocean, which covers the largest part of this planet. This is good, and it's terrible news. If someone tries to scare you, saying this new science shows we will heat up to 5 degrees C hotter, a point where mass extinctions are likely, during this century, they may be abusing the science. That mega warming is unlikely in your lifetime. That's the good news. But as Palmer points out, carbon dioxide can last in the atmosphere for tens of thousands of years. Humans are now resetting the global thermostat for all future generations, for the plants, animals, and all life. Imagine that Europeans in the year 1820 knew their use of coal would destroy habitability on large parts of the planet 200 years later. They would not experience the impacts of their pollution, but that killer heat would be coming on, well, right about now. We are making that decision for our descendants. But it appears we are so short-sighted we only care about what happens when we are alive. That's what it looks like now, as we fail to address the climate emergency. For decades, the United Nations International Energy Agency spoke for the fossil fuel industry and fossil-powered life in general. This week, the director, Fatih Birol, of the IEA, announced, "We have only the next 6 months to avoid a climate disaster." During the pandemic, we are using and emitting far less oil, gas, and coal carbon dioxide. If national governments attempt to go back to normal, the old ways, the rebound will lead to unstoppable global warming. Birol told the UK's Guardian newspaper, quote, "The next 3 years will determine the course of the next 30 years and beyond. If we do not take action, we will surely see a rebound in emissions. If emissions rebound, it is very difficult to see how they will be brought down in the future. This is why we are urging governments to have sustainable recovery packages," end quote from Fatih Birol. British airports and fields are full of unsold cars, no doubt almost all of them fossil fuel burners. Almost all countries have millions of parked new cars just waiting. On the BBC, a presenter wondered if those cars will be sold at all. Will British car makers need to start up again in the near future? Well, Germany announced large-scale government financing for German carmakers to switch over to producing the automobiles of the future now, electric cars and trucks. This is the chance we have to take a different path right out of this pandemic. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our future.